Your body is going to undergo compressed, jury-rigged metamorphosis.
Damn the ramparts, Doctor.
Space. The final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
The present episode will make mention of events depicted up through the final episode of Star Trek Strange New Worlds first season. If you don't want to look into the Orb of the Prophets, pause now and return later. Welcome to episode 60 of Gimme That Star Trek, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Siskoid, and on this final episode of the season, we're talking about recasting. It happens that from time to time, a character must be recast, as with the Borg Queen in Voyager, or J.J. Abrams' Star Trek films, which needed younger models of the TOS characters, and we are living in an age of prequels now with Star Trek Discovery and Strange New Worlds, now recasting many characters from the original series. To help me discuss this is a friend of the network, but first-time guest on this show, Corey Musa, welcome to Gimme That Star Trek.
Hi, Siskoid. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You work in the film industry, but you haven't had to recast any characters as far as I know, right?
That has not been one of my job assignments now.
The real reason I invited you is because I know you've been enjoying the new shows. You know, some people are just stuck on the originals. Yep. But to talk about recasting, you need people that have been following new Trek, maybe we want to call it. So have you been enjoying this last couple years of new Trek?
I've been enjoying it enormously. It's like lifted my spirits up. I think it's the best Star Trek yet. I've been really excited. I mean, I was really hesitant when Discovery first news started coming out about Discovery, and when I heard it was going to be a prequel, I was like, my gosh, another prequel? How many prequels do we need? Like, I want to know what happens after. And I really wasn't excited about it. And I didn't even watch it the first season. And for whatever reason, I finally broke down and I decided I was going to watch it. And then I like binged it. And when I finished the first season, I was like, wow, that was actually really good. I thought it started off kind of rough and then it got really good. And by the time they finished season two, I was like, wow, that's actually the best acting I think I've ever seen on any Star Trek was happening right there in those episodes. Like they had cast a whole round of really talented actors. And I thought it was really cool. And, you know, now with Strange New Worlds is like my new favorite Star Trek show of all time. I think Anson Mount is so charming and has so much charisma. I have been enjoying watching him so much. I think he's great. So, yeah, I am super pleased with New Trek, as you'd call it. And I mean, the reality is we have a resurgence in Star Trek right now. I'm so happy that it's happening.
You got your wish because, yes, Discovery was a prequel, but then it jumped ahead a few centuries and we are seeing what happened next.
It was so cool. It went from being a show where I was like, I don't need this. I just need to see what actually happens after we left off with like the Next Generation timeline, and they supercharged that and I couldn't be happier. I'm so excited about it. And I'm so excited that we get this reality where there's like three timelines we're exploring on, you know, live streaming TV right now between the Picard and the original, not the original, but like the Next Generation timeline that encompasses Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And then you have like kind of the original series timeline that's where Strange New Worlds and season one and two of Discovery took place. And now you have this like ridiculous, how many years in the future are they? Do you remember?
I think it's the next millennium. It's the beginning of the next millennium.
It's crazy. I love the idea of it, and I think it's really cool.
Not to mention, of course, Lower Decks and Prodigy.
I know, so much.
Because this is your first time You must answer the usual questionnaire that shows what kind of Trek fan you are, although you've sort of started to do that. And the first question is, what does Star Trek mean to you? How did you come about it, and what place has it taken in your life?
Oh, boy. Star Trek means so many different things to me in so many different ways across so many different periods of my life. It is defined over and over again who I've become and what has happened in my life. I guess Star Trek was just a thing that was on TV when I was a little kid, as many of us were. I remember being, as a really, really a kid, I was actually in Montreal. They were showing Star Trek reruns on TV. The babysitter had it on. The episode was the Spock's brain episode. And I was fascinated, pun intended, because what was that? It actually scared me, kind of scared me in a way where I needed to see more Star Trek. So I just started watching it. I knew what time it came on. It came on every day. And almost immediately there was like commercials for a convention that Nichelle Nichols was appearing at. And I remember begging my grandmother to take me, but she wouldn't. So we went to like the bookstore instead. And I remember buying this copy of, I think it's J.M. Dillard's The Lost Years. And I, you know, hadn't even seen any of the Star Trek movies at this point, but I read that book and I thought it was so cool. And anyway, I just became very obsessed with it as a little kid. And I wasn't embarrassed about it. And I had a little uniform that I would wear. I wore it to school sometimes. I had pointy ears that I would put on with the uniform, and I was really proud of it. I loved it so much, you know, that I got into acting because I wanted to be on Star Trek. I went to those conventions and I would speak to the actors. I was a little kid asking questions, and I just wanted to know what I wanted to make pretend in the greatest way possible, which was basically getting to be an actor and be on one of those sets and to be in one of those movies. So it was like somewhere probably around 14 or 15 that my gears shifted from Star Trek into theater and getting into college and all of that, where Star Trek always remained this huge part of my life. I would have my mom sent me like VHS tapes of all the new episodes of Deep Space Nine and Voyager as they were airing when I was in undergraduate, so I could keep watching them because I didn't have a TV cable or anything like that. And I continued going to Star Trek conventions when I was at college. Like at college, my friends all thought I was crazy. I made a big deal about Star Trek in college. I was in theater school. I was at this college called Carnegie Mellon University. Or studying acting. It's like an actual hard program to get into. And everybody was very pretentious, but I just wanted to talk about Star Trek. And I tried to do Hamlet in Klingon at the university. I got some pushback on that. I definitely taught a course in Klingon at one point at the university. That was fun. Look, the weird thing about all of that is just that I went to college with who became my future producing partner years later, which was Zachary Quinto. And, you know, Zachary Quinto, who, for those of you who don't know, went on to become Spock in the rebooted J.J. Abrams films. And when Zach got cast in that role, he reached out to me and he legitimately was like, help, I don't know anything about Star Trek. And he, just like everybody else, like, you know, from college, knew what a dork I was about it. And I was living in New York at the time, and I just kind of flew out to L.A. and we just started working together, and one thing led to another. And that was like one of the most significant moments in my life, probably right there, was the fact that everything in my life changed in this moment where I had moved to L.A. and all of a sudden I had my foot in the door of like the Hollywood entertainment industry. I had been deep into theater. Where I was still obsessing over Star Trek and doing a one-man play where I use Star Trek metaphors to explain viruses. Yeah, man, I'm a dork. I know. Okay. So my point is that I'm getting to is like it changed my life. I started working in Hollywood. I started producing movies and I just started working in this business professionally. Definitely when the second Star Trek movie came around that J.J. Abrams directed, I had the opportunity to like go on set And I had the opportunity to be an extra one day in like a funeral scene that was happening for Pike. I got to hang out with the cast in their dressing rooms all day. And I got to go to the premiere and I got to sit in between Quinto and Chris Pine. And it was all like very surreal. And I felt like it was all happening just for me at that exact moment when it was happening. And I mean, the reality is Star Trek led me on that whole journey that I took and many other ones. And it continues to lead me on a path that is remarkable because it connects me to people. It connects me to subjects. It connects me to businesses. It connects me to culture. It connects me to language. There's so many different things that it connects me to because Star Trek is a very universal experience. All right.
Well, I wanted to say really early on that my first Star Trek was also in Montreal. So that's the first time I ever saw an episode of Star Trek was at an aunt's house when we were visiting in Montreal, in French, I believe.
It was in French, too, when I saw it, for sure. Yeah.
Mine was the Enterprise incident. A little more cred. Some people find it odd that I would be, you know, out there in the world talking about Star Trek or Doctor Who or comic books, even in the workplace. Because some workplaces frown on that, or a lot of people still, I don't know, they have their old bully brain from high school or something where they think that's something to be ashamed of. But in reality, everybody I've ever spoken to about these things or realized that I enjoy these subjects and can talk about them profusely, that also created opportunities for me, you know, including finding myself here today doing podcasts on the Fire and Water Network, which doesn't sound as big as Hollywood, but it's still connections with people, etc.
Yes.
There's really no shame in it because people actually kind of respect you for it. If anything you do, 100%, people respect you for it. So let's get to the next question. What's your favorite iteration of the show? Because you said, like, okay, this might be the best Trek ever right now, but best and favorite are not necessarily the same thing. So what's your favorite show of all the Treks?
I mean, my comfort food of Star Trek is going to be Star Trek The Next Generation, hands down, no doubt. That would be the one I would go to. Even though it was not the original Trek I was exposed to, I connected with it always a lot more than the original Trek.
What's your favorite character in this or any iteration, really?
My favorite character. I'm going to go with Odo. I do like me some Odo. I know I didn't say Deep Space Nine was my favorite show, but Deep Space Nine might have had some of the most interesting characters introduced on it. And I think Odo was a great layered character played brilliantly by Rene Auberjonois, who was the commencement speaker my senior year of college and introduced our graduating class in L.A. And he was there my senior. He went to Carnegie Mellon and he was just there. And he was just it was like some kind of anniversary or groundbreaking we were doing for a new building. And so he was there and he came to see all the plays we were in. And it was pretty cool. I spoke to him a bunch. And I tried to pretend that I wasn't a Star Trek nerd. I remember I was just like, no, I'm really into you because of Benson. I really like Benson. And, you know, and MASH, the movie of MASH.
Did that work?
Yeah, I think it worked great. His wife or girlfriend or whatever was like, look, Renee, he looks just like your son. And I was like, oh, we have a personal connection now. They think I look like family.
You have many connections to Star Trek, as it turns out. What's your favorite Star Trek culture or species, then? Because is it the Klingons, since you mentioned them in your origin story?
Oh, well, you know, I think I always liked the Klingons so much because there was probably the most about them when I was young on any of the other species that we had on Star Trek. The Klingons, you know, especially in the Next Generation era, got highlighted so prominently. And I do. I have a real love for the Klingons. I'm trying to think if I like another species equally or I'm as fascinated by. No, the Klingons are pretty good. I also like that the Klingons, for some reason, the Klingons had Shakespeare on their planet. So. There you go.
I know some as well. So, okay. So now we know what sort of Star Trek fan you are. You're probably the Star Trek fan with the most geek cred that I've ever had on the show, present company included. So that's the kind of fan you are. Let's talk about the topic now. Let's start with a question, both simple and complex. What would you look for in a good recasting? Of course, recasting needs to be done and if certain projects are to move forward. We're not going to be talking about, okay, you know, they're recasting, they're doing a scene with baby Spock or whatever. It's not about that. It's about adult actors taking over roles. It's somewhere in the timeline, you know, that makes them kind of recurring characters. So what do you look for as a good recasting? Like, what are the qualities we're looking for here?
You know, I think what you need to find is somebody who is not doing an impression of the actor, which I think we've seen, like, is a good idea in the Abrams movies, to stay away from, like, trying to do a direct impression. Because Chris Pine, what he did was really subtle in terms of a Shatner. He just embodied that cockiness, and it was really, really cool. So being able to embody who that character is, or at least who we want them to be, is important, more so than if the actor looks the part as much as you would want them to. I think that's all relative these days. Like, just dye their hair if you need to, or shave their head if you need to, or don't, because it's a prequel. If we were going to do something in Next Generation, right, look at a prequel show, it would be great to see that Stargazer show, right, with a young Picard. And that would be the only recast, really, I would do on that show. And then you'd have a new cast of characters. You'd have, like, Jack Crusher. And I'd, like, cast, like, Matt Bomer as that or something. Picard, you know, you would easily want to see if James McAvoy was available, because he's already proven himself. And you clearly would want to check with Tom Hardy. Picard is a weird one, because there are two actors that are associated with, like, young Patrick Stewart that are really high caliber actors. So either one of them would be welcomed by, I think, the fans and myself in reprising that role. But yeah, I think anybody who's going to take on these iconic roles just has to be respectful to them. I don't think that they need to try and... I think they need to bring something different to them. I think that's important. And they need to bring a little bit of themselves to them. And we as the audience need to just kind of... If we want to keep seeing stories about these characters, then we need to kind of accept that.
Yeah, it's not all about looks, because personality, what you bring to it. I wonder if, does the actor, or is almost more the work of the writers behind that, do they have to know their Trek so that they can find a certain something? You actually guided an actor into that, you know, into doing a role like this. So what's the research?
There actually is a certain amount that would be left well done by actors who are not Star Trek fans, by actors who do not know these characters intimately. I don't think when it comes to something like Star Trek, where there are just hours upon hours of lore and backstory and all of that, that it's not necessarily a good thing for an actor to go and watch every single episode of a series to try and capture and embody who that is, because they need to be able to bring something of themselves to it. And in order to do that, like, it really is helpful if they don't necessarily have all of those bits and pieces and they feel comfortable in filling some of it in for themselves. I mean, and particularly in how we're doing some of this recasting anyway, it just kind of depends. Are we in an alternate timeline recasting? Are we in the actual timeline? Because then you can allow for these recastings to have all these nuances and differences that really shouldn't matter at all, because they're not really the same person.
Or even if they're younger, well, we don't know what Uhura was like during her cadet years, so...
We don't. And, like, the retcons that they've been doing on Strange New Worlds, I think they're great, whatever. It's like, even if certain things don't fit perfectly, I don't care. It's pretty cool that it's fitting together at all.
I mean, it's surprisingly fits very well. One of the things that I've been doing, watching Strange New Worlds, is going back to some of the original series episodes afterwards. Hopefully people have seen it enough that I'm not spoiling anything, but T'Pring, for example, is in this show. The, you know, Spock's betrothed. But it always seemed when you watch the original series that you hadn't seen her since she was a kid, because he had a picture of her as a child or something, that they were, you know, matched at that point and just had, you know, gone their separate ways or something.
That's what the story is. Yeah. They were matched as children and never saw each other again.
The episode does not say that. I watched A Mock Time like what I was really watching for is that Christine Chapel and Uhura, that their reactions made sense when they saw T'Pring on the bridge in Amok Time. And it works. Christine doesn't say a thing, so she doesn't let on that she knows her. And only Uhura, who doesn't meet her in the episodes as yet, makes mention, oh, she's beautiful, Mr. Spock, or whatever. They're really skirting the line, probably. And it's like, what can we actually do without contradicting canon? And I think they're doing it while still allowing for performances to live and breathe.
Yes, agree with you that that's all that's happening. And it's actually adding a lot. It makes Spock more interesting. I mean, it's great. I love getting some backstory. It actually makes the episode all the more tragic, Amok Time, when you watch it with this backstory in mind. So have you watched any of the other episodes and compared? I'm curious, like, on the two-part episode in the original series that uses the cage footage.
The Menagerie.
Yeah. Does Uhura seem to know who Pike is ever? Or, you know, like, what are her reactions in that episode?
She's there, but she's not in any proximity to Pike. She doesn't say anything, but she's not the court reporter. You know, there's like another person right. dressed in red. It could have been her, but it's not. So it's not problematic in that sense. And a lot of the details, I was surprised at how many of the details that are mentioned about the accident are the actual ones that they used in Discovery and then Strange New Worlds. And Spock, from the get-go in the Menagerie, Spock has this plan. Pike doesn't want him to go through with it. Like, the accident just happened very recently in that episode. And Spock is already on this mission. Spock has already decided he was going to do this. How can Spock know to do, like, where did this plan come up? And so quickly? Well, it's because he was planning for it all this time. So the show is actually, through retcons, I guess, explaining certain plot holes.
It's awesome. I mean, it's actually awesome. And to think that all of this is being created out of something that was created as a way to save money, like in the 60s. This is all really, like, you know, between being based on the Menagerie, just finding an excuse to be able to recycle the pilot episode into another episode, creating this weird storyline for Pike being in this wheelchair and that who this other captain of the Enterprise was. It was never a necessary episode that needed to happen of Star Trek. And now it's like spawned this incredible backstory. Like, that is awesome. I mean, man, I love this show. What a great 10 episodes they gave us.
It shouldn't even have worked in the Menagerie. You know, the Menagerie itself shouldn't have worked as a concept for an episode. But somehow, you know, they put all the pieces back together and made something that has resonated and stuck with us. So to get back to the recasting, we're seeing like the necessity for recasting and what recasting actually allows us to do. So I think this tangent isn't a waste of time. You know, it's like, well, why do we recast? We recast because we can go back and tell these interstitial stories, you know, and they actually make things like the stories we know deeper in a way. That's what it allows us to do.
Because we love these characters so much that, like, we're not done with them. What do you want? Like, this is the way to continue it going. It's fair, perhaps, Siskoid, to, like, bring up the fact that, you know, what Star Wars has been getting away with and starting to do with technology and, you know, somehow having youthful Mark Hamill appear in several episodes of The Mandalorian and Boba Fett.
Right.
And it's like,
You think that's less interesting?
I think it's less interesting to do that and not. I mean, there's something that could be really, it's like you're going to almost have actors wearing face masks. That, like, that's what's going to be happening in the near future. And face masks meaning like digital face mask, where some kind of filter is used to put a, you know, young Shatner, young Patrick Stewart onto another actor's face and put the performance there. And it's becoming more and more real and affordable to do that. And we'll have less of a reason to, we won't necessarily have to recast. We could potentially, you know,
at the risk of creating zombies, you know, because eventually, like, if we lose these actors now, I don't really want the digital version of, you know, an actor that has passed. I think that's a little creepy and distracting.
It's coming. That is our future. I mean, I think you're going to get to see a Star Trek movie one day that stars Lucille Ball and, I don't know, Katharine Hepburn or something. We'll get Katharine Hepburn to play young Janeway. I mean...
Yeah, that makes sense.
I know, it would make a lot of sense, and Lucille Ball definitely deserves a role on Star Trek. Come on.
Let me bring it back to something you said earlier about alternate timelines, etc., allowing for a deviation in performance. Because I think that what we're really looking at as fans is that the spirit of the character needs to be there, and that the personality is at least understandable as the character that we know, because we like them, we love them because of their personalities, not because of their looks necessarily. So we understand how the J.J. Abrams films work. They're younger, it's a different timeline, they haven't lived the same lives, so there can be deviation. When we look at Pike, etc., especially Pike in Number One, these are characters that we met a long time ago. There's not much to with them. You know, there's just one episode, one little storyline. We're seeing them a few years later. Again, plenty of room to play for the actors. But there's also, like within the same timeline, back-to-back sort of thing, I want to bring in the case of Saavik. First, we had Kirstie Alley, who played her as an emotional half-Romulan. And then what appears to be days later, she is now Robin Curtis, who's a very cold, full Vulcan. So what do you think of that as an example of a recasting that has totally changed the personality, and yet there are fans of both?
Yeah, I just always have accepted that, I guess, Star Trek Part 2 and 3 happen in alternate realities. But if they didn't, and no, if just the recasting of it, it's like, it's so weird. I don't know. That's an interesting case. There's like a huge case to be made that Robin Curtis is much more appropriate in the role. But Kirstie Alley was extremely likable as Saavik in Wrath of Khan. Extremely likable. If you had made it Robin Curtis, I don't know how that whole movie would have changed tonally. They would have probably never cast her in the role in that movie. They still would have gone in a different direction. But the Saavik that we see in Star Trek III is very, she's very Vulcan, and she's on a direct, I don't know, she's on a direct mission. She's kind of the person in charge in that movie because she's with David basically the whole time. She doesn't have a superior officer over her. It just gives us a different Saavik in a different situation.
In between the two movies, she did a little bit meditation and stuff, you know, like Spock. Younger Spock was more emotional.
It's so interesting. I mean, if Kirstie Alley had stayed with them, I don't know. Star Trek III would have ended up differently. And Star Trek IV might have very well had Saavik coming along for the ride back in time. And let me say, how old is Saavik? Saavik is Vulcan. I would like to see Saavik come back. I would like to see them offer this role to Kirstie Alley and like just have her come to a Saavik show. I think there should be a spinoff Saavik show that takes place. I think it should take place in the Picard timeline that we're in right now and have like, you know, 200-year-old Saavik. She can be doing something on a starship and it'll be great. And it'll give Kirstie Alley work back to, I mean, come on, it would be poetic. Like that was the first movie I ever think I noticed where I saw the person who had an introducing credit in the movie. And it was introducing Kirstie Alley. That's a cool thing you negotiated into your contract. You should come be on Star Trek again.
That'd be interesting. The case of Saavik, she's the OG. For me, it's like this is the first recast in Star Trek, I think. If we discount people playing their own selves as kids or, you know, whatnot.
Sure.
This is the first recasting. So it's interesting that it's the one that really goes in another direction, essentially, you know. I'm the same. I can't tell if it's a successful recasting or not. You know, because it is so unusual.
It's so unusual. I had a soft spot for both versions of Saavik. When I was a kid and I was at a Star Trek convention, I was like the strange kid who they used to have these auctions they would do at the conventions, and they would auction off memorabilia or toys or whatever. And at one point they auctioned off a cocktail napkin that Robin Curtis had kissed and signed, and I bought that cocktail napkin. I bid on it. That was like the first time I ever bid at anything in an auction, and I just put my lips up against it. That's what I wanted to do.
Wow. I think personally I like the original better than the the recast, almost to the point where, why didn't they just like create a new character if she's going to be this different? But then we would lose the one line that I often quote, where she says, "David is dead." You know, that kind of delivery, which I love. So, you know, I can't lose that.
Ah, God, I can't wait till we get to do a commentary for Star Trek III.
I'm sure Rob has it in the works. So, okay, but well, that one, we don't know if it's successful or not because it's so weird. But what about successful recasting? How about doing a little back and forth?
All right, I'll go with Chris Pine first. Chris Pine, I saw that Star Trek movie before like anybody did. I had a private screening of it that I got to go to with Zach. And I was so excited, and I remember having to sign all these non-disclosure agreements and talking to, like, it was Brian Burke after the movie was over. I was like the first quote-unquote Star Trek fan to see it, and I was blown away by, I mean of course I thought Zach was great, but I was like blown away by Chris Pine because he embodied that whole cowboy kind of swagger, thumbing his nose to authority personality without remotely doing some kind of tasteless Shatner impersonation. So I thought he did a really great job at embodying that role.
Yeah, nobody can do the Shatner cadence, you know, without sounding like just like parody. So I agree. Chris Pine was on my list. I think as a young man, he has the right spark. But then by the time we get to Beyond, in Star Trek Beyond, he's merged with the Captain Kirk of the original series. He's supposed to be that around that age. He's more like Roddenberry's Kirk, the one who is conflicted. He's the captain of a ship, so he can't have no love, but he's got all this responsibility. He's friends with some of the crew, but also he can't really be friends with them. So there's often that sort of thing going on, this turmoil going on in Kirk. It's true of most of the great episodes. And I think in Beyond, he's at that crossroads. He's at that young middle age where he's wondering if he's on the right track. And I feel that turmoil in him in Star Trek Beyond. So I feel like eventually the two performances merged in that film. So Chris Pine definitely on my list. One I would also name from the Abrams films, oddly, is Simon Pegg as Scotty. Not because of the performance, because I think the performance is much more comedic than on the show, although the show did have those moments. So it seems like he was the far-off casting of the lot, in a way. But then I saw some side-by-side comparisons. Well, not really, but I was looking at both actors, you know.
Yeah.
There's something in the facial features, and I felt there's a strong similarity there. So kudos to whoever put those.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Simon Pegg actually was great casting, and I thought he was a good match for James Doohan. And it's like James Doohan was always kind of a parody anyway.
Yes, right. The accent wasn't his own. You know, both these men are doing an accent.
And so that all felt just. And yeah, I agree. I mean, like we have been talking about, the Abrams movies did a good job with a lot of the casting. I'll take a stab again. I'll say, just because we're on the Abrams movies still, also Carl Urban, like, this guy is not DeForest Kelly. This guy is like a manly man, and DeForest Kelly just had a smaller frame and, you know,
softer touch, even though he played bad guys for years, you know, before. So he had that hard edge, but on the show, he just showed that other side.
And yeah, Carl Urban, I don't think that casting was weird to me when it happened. But when I saw the movie, I was just like, yep. He's also embodying this character without doing a parody. He had the right grumpiness, the discontent for Spock, and all the other characteristics were there and were his own, weren't a carbon copy of DeForest Kelly in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think they're well cast in general. So who else would you put on your list of greats?
I mean, Anson Mount right now is amazing, and it's a bit of a different situation because, you know, he's bringing a character to life that, as we were saying, had, you know, one episode, not that much screen time to begin with, and it was basically a blank slate. He did such a great job on season two of Discovery, winning you over. He wins you over very quickly,
incredibly. Like, he shot up in the lists of favorite captains very, very quickly. for many people.
It's like weird. The guy is super charming, I guess. I didn't know who he was before, and now I've gone back and I'm like, oh, he was in the Inhumans, yeah. And then he showed up in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, and I was like, I literally didn't know who he was, and I was very happy. And Ethan Peck was actually, I found him to be a little rough the first few episodes of Discovery. That took me a second to warm up to. I still was fighting the idea that Michael Burnham and Spock actually knew each other, but they do. And it all actually works really well. It all makes perfect sense now. Now that they've slid Cybok into the mix, everything is coming together.
Yeah, we'll see what that does. I think Ethan Peck is... his pronunciation in the dialogue is sometimes a little muddled, which bugs me, I guess, because I think of Spock as being so precise, although Spock's Boston accent is is unreproduced here. But like the word colony, for example, it almost sounds like colony when he says it. So something in his accent kind of muddles words, which I feel is less Vulcan than it should be. I mean, they're doing such good jobs that I'm nitpicking it, basically. But for me, in that show, Anson Mount really tops. I agree with you there that they've even brought back some of the stuff that Jeffrey Hunter was doing in the show. Because in Discovery, he was very funny, which was not the case of The Cage. The Cage is not a funny episode, but he was so charming and funny. And you could almost say he was more like the Bruce Greenwood Pike from the movies. So, okay. I see that personality there. Fell in love with him. Go into Strange New Worlds, and now he's had the vision of his own demise, not to say death, but, you know. And then he's haunted by it. You know, at the start of the season, he's haunted by that, and for a good while before he comes to terms with it by, hopefully, the end. The haunted feeling that he has in that series is essentially what Jeffrey Hunter was doing at the beginning of The Cage. The Cage was sort of his getting his groove back, just like Pike, yeah, Strange New Worlds Season 1 could be seen as that as well.
I agree. That's just great casting. Who else do they have? What do you think about Rainn Wilson as Harry Mudd?
Is that one of your favorites?
No, I'm not. Rainn Wilson, I didn't love what Rainn Wilson did as Harry Mudd. I'm curious to what you thought.
If we go into unsuccessful, less successful recastings in our opinions, I think we hit the big notes in terms of successful recastings. We might also have mentioned Genevieve Bugeaud getting replaced by Kate Mulgrew, but that's not quite fair. So, okay.
Oh, right. Watching that original footage with her in it is
cringy.
Just so weird. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and Genevieve Bugeaud, I would have had a secondhand connection because I'm very much friends with her cousin, Genevieve Bugeaud being a French-Canadian. So,
oh, sorry. You could have been on the Voyager set when you were younger.
Maybe. No, probably not. So, anyways, so less successful. So you would say, okay, Rainn Wilson, less of a success for you?
I didn't love him. I mean, I understand why they cast him. I thought that was more stunt casting than anything else.
Cartmell really embodied that character, was that character. He was even that character on other shows that are not Star Trek. You know, it was basically himself as Mudd, or at least it seems to me when I see him in other parts. I thought it was okay. Yeah, I think it was like a middling one. I would not have put it on either of my lists, hot or not, you know. I think it worked, but he was more sinister, so they really brought something different to it where I don't think that Cartmell's original portrayal was that sinister.
No, he wasn't a real threat. He was an accidental threat, if anything.
Yeah, so here he seems much more dangerous and much more deviating from canon in a way. So, see, it's when the personality and the way the writers use them, because it's not all the actor's fault. You know, I acknowledge here that there are a lot of difficult jobs when it comes to recasting. The actor themselves have a lot of pressure. The casting agents, obviously, that can't be easy, and you can't always get your first choice. And sometimes we're going to go, and, you know, it's not necessarily the actor's fault for getting a job. You know, I don't begrudge anyone getting a job. It's also difficult for the writers. You know, it can be the writer's fault to put Harry Mudd in certain plots that then don't really match what we see in his later years, you know? So maybe that's what the reaction here is?
Maybe.
I gotta say, I was, in terms of, like, the worst for me recasting was Paul Wesley as Kirk in that final Strange New Worlds. because I don't see Kirk physically. I don't see Kirk in personality. And I know it's a parallel history. We can sort of, but I didn't see what Shatner brings, and that I think Chris Pine brought, is a twinkle. That cocky twinkle was missing from this performance, I think.
I agree. Look, it's a weird thing to have been disappointed by the arrival of Captain Kirk. And I'm totally sorry if this is a spoiler for anybody, but yeah, it's like, we get Paul Wesley showing up as Kirk in this kind of slight, it's such a cool episode though. And the premise of this episode is so dope that they're basically revisiting the episode Balance of Terror from the original series from a different point of view. And these are the results of, you know, Captain Pike basically trying to cheat his fate and not have the accident happen. And if he doesn't have the accident happen, this alt history writes itself. And Kirk shows up, is not captain of the Enterprise because Pike is still captain of the Enterprise. And so Kirk is basically a different person because he wasn't. So Paul Wesley comes in as Kirk and he totally doesn't nail it. And it was really disappointing. I did read an interview that said that Paul Wesley had prepared something entirely different and the directors like told him to take it to a totally different direction. Wow. They were like, we don't want you to embody that Kirk because this isn't that Kirk. This is a different Kirk. So I read that was like a specific, you know, note that was given to Paul Wesley as an actor.
And a good example of how, you know, it takes a village. You know, it's not necessarily always the actor's fault or even the casting agent's fault. Any number of things can fail on a set.
I thought he was going to be so good. I remember they released an image of him like months ago. Right. And I was like, oh, that image looks great. I'm really excited. I can't wait to see this. And I was like, this dude was fine on Vampire Diaries. I'm sure he'll be great on this show. And then it was just a very bland, meh. He didn't look like Kirk. He didn't feel like Kirk. He almost looked more like Jim Carrey's Captain Kirk to me.
And yet still not doing the performance, you know? So
no, I know. No. Yeah, I agree. But I think we're going to get more of him on the show and we'll see. Because Ethan Peck definitely didn't win me over either when he had a full beard. And it took a second for me to accept that Spock. These aren't movies, you know? These are long-form television, so
we get other chances, yeah.
They have more than one chance, yeah.
Especially if he was told to modify his performance for this parallel reality, then what if we meet him in the real reality later? Then he can bring what he wanted to bring. You know, maybe that's it. Hopefully.
Should be his full swagger.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens. I don't know. Strange New Worlds is so interesting. Is this show going to just evolve into like a season of the original Star Trek? You're left to wonder. You heard them bring in a Scotty, right?
In the voice, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I've been debating with Shag online there about, you know, who they can bring and cannot bring. You know, like, for me, Kirk obviously didn't bring in the whole crew. But he must have made choices as well, you know, so, you know, and why is, you know, that other, the navigator on the ship, don't remember her first name, next to Erica, right. Her last name is Mitchell, okay, that's not a name that comes out of nowhere, you know, they're going to do something with that probably. Any other?
Should we just kind of backstep and throw Kim Cattrall into the Savick conversation?
Well, that could have been, yeah, she was supposed to be written for Savick and then, you know,
supposed to be written for Robin Curtis, mm-hmm, or Kirstie Alley.
They just didn't want to destroy the character by making her a traitor, so they changed it, which is sort of what they should have done for Savick from 2 to 3, you know, as far as. But here's a less successful one that's on my list. Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan.
Oh, right. I like almost that's like the movie that I appeared in and I've like blocked that out of my memory. And Benedict Cumberbatch is such a wonderful actor. That movie was poorly executed. Sorry, everybody who worked on it.
No, sure. I think that's a common opinion.
Yeah, it was a bad idea. Trying to hide it was a bad idea. It was all just such fan service in the wrong direction that nobody really wanted to see that. That wasn't the right way to pay respects to that movie. I don't know. It wasn't really Benedict Cumberbatch's fault. He did a fine job with
what he had. I mean, I think they were trying to play him as a sort of, okay, he's supposed to be like cloned and that's why he's so pale or odd, but I mean there's nothing And I mean, they really recreated the character is the problem, I think. But then can someone do Ricardo Montalban? I mean, you know, this seems so daunting. It's like I'm complaining about the new Captain Kirk. That is such a daunting job to take on because the character is such an icon and you feel like it would be very difficult, you know, recast that role with any legitimacy, you know.
Yeah, I just say leave that one alone, guys. I don't know. We don't need to keep exploring Khan.
No, I think we're done.
Maybe they'll give us a spinoff that's going to show us what happened with Khan between the years he was sent to SETI Alpha.
There were plans.
Six.
There were plans, right?
Was there? That was like, I remember that.
Yeah. Nick Meyer was supposedly working on a miniseries about Khan's days on SETI Alpha. I think it fell apart. As far as I know.
I guess that could still happen at some point. And then God knows we can have full episodes devoted to the ear creatures.
For some reason, I also have a lot of trouble accepting anyone but Alice Krieg as the Borg Queen. I'm always like, but I don't feel like it's necessarily the actor's fault. I think it's Alice Krieg was so good and the makeup was so much better as well. The sort of wet, sweaty makeup.
Alice Krieg was so much better than, what was her name? Suzanne
Thompson.
Thompson. That was the one on Voyager. And then this new one that's on Picard didn't even matter.
Alex Grieg forever. So sometimes it's like,
yeah, I agree.
Sometimes someone like really puts their stamp on a performance, and then when you need to recast them, yeah. There are some people that I feel are in the middle somewhere, or that we will see more of. You know, like Uhura. I like the recasting. It's a little weird that she uses Southern expressions at times because Uhura is supposedly Kenyan, but then Earth is maybe more of a tapestry at this point. I don't know.
Kenya could have changed a lot.
Yeah, I do think she's a closer recasting than Zoe Saldana. You know, so I really enjoy, like, one of the things that I enjoy about Strange New Worlds is that having Uhura in it is that we get to see, like, this is an iconic character who was not particularly well served on the series. So seeing her backstory, that's all. Just like I'd love to see Sulu's backstory, etc. You know, these are characters that are iconic, but then the original show explored them so seldom. So that gives us this chance here. Similar with Jess Bush, who I think is a hoot as the younger Christine Chapel.
I'm like in love with the new Nurse Chapel. I want to marry the new Nurse Chapel.
She's so punky, and she's got tattoos on her fingers, which I don't know. Does she get rid of them before TOS? Yeah, I really enjoy these performances.
I agree. I mean, bravo. Bravo to this show and the people putting it together and getting something so well done.
And it's very funny to me that there are two Majel Barretts on that show.
There are totally two Majel Barretts. It's true.
And I think we need some sort of Luoxana's ancestor or something.
Well, if you count the computer voice, technically there would be three Majel Barretts on the show, right? I loved it. I loved it. And after Picard, I was, you know, I didn't love Picard season two, and I loved Strange New Worlds. So they like hit the spot that I had missed with season two of Picard.
I have to agree with that. So for fun, this last section. Right now, the TNG cast is getting older. We might imagine that in the future, perhaps a future where we're still alive and watching TV, someone would want to recast those characters as well. You mentioned the Stargazer show, which I think, you know, you could have a Picard in there. And of course, I agree. There could be some sort of, you know, in between generations and first contact. Or, you know, in the future, they might want to recast these characters. Let's say they do. Who would we cast? Or do we have any casting ideas? I'm very terrible at this. I've never been good at it. So I looked at other people's efforts online. I saw some of the better ones, which I might mention. But first, did you have any ideas?
I mean, it's hard. I don't think I would end up using actors that were known actors in any of the replacements for this.
And that would be more realistic. You know, like most of these fan castings that I see, they're all like movie stars. I mean, well, you're not going to slum it.
Well, I mean, I really would be thinking at it as a producer. So I'd be like, yeah, I mean, Jessica Chastain is not going to play Beverly Crusher.
No.
Like, and James McAvoy is probably not going to be playing Captain Picard. That would be a reality. If I would cast Data, here's one. I would do Data with Bo Burnham.
Bo Burnham as Data is very interesting. Yeah. And they might look alike. There's something there.
I think he could do it. I think he would embody it. I would throw it to him if you asked me to do it, like, right now, if I had to cast it.
He certainly has the precision of a Data, you know? I think that's interesting. I'm sure he would never do it, but it's interesting, certainly Probably. Interesting. Some of the fun ones that I saw online is like Chris O'Dowd as Miles O'Brien. They had Katie Sackhoff as Tasha Yar or something, you know, stuff like that. It seems,
That's so obvious.
Yeah, exactly. Their Data, the Data I saw is Richard Ayoade as Data would be a totally different take. I think they're just playing on the fact that he himself laughs at himself as being robotic. I perhaps like better the idea of a non-binary Data played by Tilda Swinton. Although, again, this is like movie star territory.
Oh, I remember that fan casting at some point. Nope, we can't just give Tilda Swinton all the roles for androids and Asian people. No. It's wrong.
And yeah, you mentioned Jessica Chastain as Beverly Crusher. I saw that a number of times. Like, if it's a movie, if it's a TV show, she's played by Felicia Day. You know, it's that kind of
right.
of casting.
Right. But
name
I mean,
a redhead.
Be younger than these people, Katie Sackhoff, Felicia Day. They'd be like, you know, actors in their mid-20s to early 30s.
You need younger people, yeah.
Be like the kids that are on, you know, CW shows.
And that's probably what we get. It's exactly like we're watching Strange New Worlds now. We're enjoying these recastings, but who are these actors? You know, we don't necessarily know a lot of their projects from before. Because they have to play the younger models.
Just like cast the best actor for the role. When it comes to these things now, like Star Trek, Star Wars, Marvel, people are not watching it because the actor's name is not what's bringing them to the movie or the channel. It's like the franchise. The franchise is what has the value. The characters have the value. It's just kind of switched right now.
And there's a bonus if it's an actor you know or appreciate, you know.
Yeah, but sometimes it really can just work against it. Like, I mean, casting Ben Affleck as Batman is a great example of something that just was never going to work.
Right.
It's just too much. Too big a star, too Ben Affleck. I don't know.
Let me just end then on a final question. Right now, we're seeing a lot of recasting for the original series. Or is there a character from the original series that you'd love to see come back and, of course, be recast?
If I'm allowed to pick a guest character, I would like to see the Squire of Gothos come back. I want Trelane to come back. I don't know who I want to play him, but I just want them to canonize Trelane as a Q and do it.
Ah, well, then there's the value in it. Very good. I think that's all the time that we had tonight to talk about this facet of Star Trek. It's a growing facet. We're going to get more and more of it. So get used to it, people. New actors are going to come in and put their own stamp and their own spin on the characters you love. And maybe you'll love them even more for it. Corey, what are you working on? Anything you want to mention at this juncture?
Yeah, I want to mention that to all of the nerds, we won. Everything we wanted is happening. And now there's like a new episode of Star Trek on every week. Every week. How cool is that?
There you go. Thanks again, Corey. The Transporter Chief awaits. Hopefully your reconstituted atoms will still look like you on the other end. And while you fret about that, I'll stick around for Subspace Transmissions. That's your feedback on our previous episode.
Film and Water Podcast, a weekly show about movies old and new, hosted by obsessive movie nerd Rob Kelly and a rotating series of special guests. From sci-fi to horror, dramas to family films, comedies to adventure epics, we watch it all. The Film and Water Podcast is part of the Fire and Water family of podcasts, available weekly at fireandwaterpodcast.blogspot.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Incoming Subspace Transmissions, a selection of your feedback on our previous episode in which Rich Hendley and I talked about Assignment Earth. David Gallagher was quick to say Assignment Earth was one of his favorite episodes. Ido Bosnar says Assignment Earth has always been an episode of Star Trek that I've found enjoyable and that also endlessly intrigues me, mainly because, like you and many others, I've often found myself wondering what a series based on it would have been like back in the 60s. As for the use of the concepts and characters in later Star Trek media, I've only consumed one, the IDW miniseries by Byrne, which I found quite enjoyable, and here I have to stress how emphatically I agree with Rich. I absolutely love Byrne's Trek comics, at least the ones he both wrote and drew. I haven't yet read New Visions, but they certainly sound interesting. Chris Franklin, for his part, says that as a kid, he never liked Assignment Earth. He says, I smelled the spinoff, and I didn't like the peanut butter in my Star Trek chocolate. Now I can see the possibilities, and Robert Lansing and Terry Garr have a certain chemistry I can see carrying the series. I had no idea this had anything to do with Picard Season 2, but I guess that's what I get for putting off watching it. Sorry about the spoilers, Chris. Kirk G mentions that Terry Garr says she hated the episode and will not talk about it. Apparently something bad happened associated with it, and she won't go there. Well, she once did go there, Kirk, and she talked about how Roddenberry walked on set and bluntly told the wardrobe people to hitch her skirt up a few more inches, which made her feel objectified. It doesn't take much digging to find stories about Roddenberry and other production people being extremely sexist or even exhibiting sexual misbehavior in this era. Terry Garr may have dodged a bullet when the pilot wasn't picked up. Who knows? Rob McCarthy asks if any scripts were written, and for my research, I'd say no. First of all, the first step is the creation of an outline long before a script can be greenlit, and even that would have required seed money Roddenberry didn't have. At best, he might have had one paragraph blurbs for episodes, but no such document survives in the Star Trek archives, and given how complete these are, I would be of the opinion that no such document exists. And Jack Bond asks about the Questor tapes, which would have been off topic for us, Jack, but I will say that Greg Cox references it in Assignment Eternity with Gary and Roberta helping the android from that other proposed series. Just one more of the connections he makes in the novel. The Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or monthly donation. It even unlocks rewards. For example, for $5 a month, you could get yourself on the Starfleet commendations list, like the big bird of the galaxy, Doug Van Diver. Join Doug and I in the fleet at patreon.com. And as usual, let me remind you that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com, on the Fire and Water Facebook page, on Twitter, where we are FW Podcast. Until the next episode, which will be in 2023, this is Siskoid reminding you to go boldly.